KPBS On Demand is supported by the San Diego County Toyota Dealers, presenting the new 2024 RAV4 with on- and off-the-road versatility and up to a 262-mile range with gas, hybrid, and plug-in options available. Visit your Toyota dealer for more. San Diego County Toyota Dealers. We make it easy.
It's time for Midday Edition on KPBS. Today marks the 60th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. We'll look at the past, present, and future of the movement here in San Diego. Here's to conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. We'll talk about what San Diego was like in the 1960s.
When we imagine the Civil Rights era, and when we imagine the work of the Civil Rights, and we imagine the cities of the Civil Rights and the scenes, rarely do we think of beach towns.
Then Civil Rights activist Dr. Harold K. Brown joins us to talk about his work and experience during the movement. Plus, we'll look ahead at what the next phase of the Civil Rights movement should look like. That's ahead on Midday Edition. Today marks the 60th anniversary of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. So we're looking at the history leading up to the passage of the law, the people who were part of the movement, the impact of the act, and the fight that continues today. We'll start the conversation with a look back at San Diego's history during the Civil Rights Movement. Joining me now is Montague Williams, professor of church, culture, and society at Point Loma Nazarene University. He's also author of Church in Color, Youth Ministry, Race, and the Theology of Martin Luther King Jr. Montague, welcome back to Midday Edition.
Oh, it's really good to be here. Thank you, Jade. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Also with us is Seth Malios, professor of anthropology and university history curator at San Diego State University. Seth, also welcome back to Midday Edition.
Thanks so much, Jade.
Well, I'm excited to get into this conversation, and I want to start by talking about what the Civil Rights Act is and what it accomplished in 1964. Montague, I'll start with you.
Well, you know, in 1964, there were several states that were resisting the call to desegregate. And the Civil Rights Act of 1964, what it ultimately does is that it calls all states to comply with desegregation. As you noted, you know, it prohibits discrimination in public places. It provided for the integration of schools and other public spaces. It made it illegal to discriminate in terms of employment.
Mm-hmm. And so what does this mean for communities across the U.S.?
Well, for many communities across the U.S., it meant that a lot of the strongholds keeping the grips of oppression alive, a lot of those strongholds were seen to now be weakening. And it meant that there were now hopes for people to have jobs that they were barred from or to gather in places that they were barred from. And, you know, a lot of the findings is it actually impacts one's sense of self. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, it was an attack on the myth that some people are superior and more human and some people are inferior and less human than others, all on the basis of race, skin color. And this provided a call for the nation to challenge that myth together.
Well, can you set the scene in San Diego? I mean, what was the cultural and political landscape like during the Civil Rights Movement?
One of the big myths that's perpetuated about San Diego is that it's part of California writ large as the Golden State that was a land of equality. And this is both during admission to the Union and then all the way through the 1960s. And it's just not true. Carol Wayman, who started the Black History Department at San Diego State in the 60s, he accurately called San Diego the Mississippi of the West. Yeah. And what he meant by that was this was an area that was actively segregated. Discrimination was everywhere. Part of that stemmed from the fact that so many Southerners had come to Southern California, whereas Northerners had come to Northern California. But it also had to do with the business of real estate, where some of the most despicable segregation and discrimination that was going on was being pushed by San Diego and Southern California realtors. And so you have a time where Black San Diegans could only live in a couple of neighborhoods, couldn't get jobs at many stores, couldn't try on clothes. It was actively segregated. And just to set the stage, when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. arrives in San Diego, comes out to San Diego State, he's met with protesters. He was not warmly embraced. He was called a communist, and there were all sorts of people handing out leaflets and arguing against him being here.
You all have done a great job of painting the picture of the climate, both here in San Diego and across the country. And when Dr. King visits San Diego, he specifically stops in at college campuses. What do we know about his visits, Seth?
Yeah, when it comes to the San Diego State visit, he had been to San Diego a couple of times before and had been invited many times. And so there was a lot of excitement, but at San Diego State, because it's virtually an all-white campus, he's not well received. And what's so fascinating about this is that he's such a skillful speaker that the speech he ends up giving at San Diego State, it's very analytical. It's more of a lecture than an inspirational speech, very different from the speech he then gives at Cal Western later in the day. It's almost lawyerly, the way he has a three-point program, and he hammers through these points that the American dream is the world dream. And then he gets that notion that Montaigne brought up earlier of debunking any notion of superior and inferior races. And then the third point he says is act now. And some of his best quotes from the speech are, you can't legislate integration, but you can legislate desegregation. Mm-hmm. Laws can't make you love me, but they can keep you from lynching me.
Wow. And he gave the remaining awake through a great revolution speech at Cal Western, yes, now known as Point Loma Nazarene University. Montaigne, what was the impact of his presence at Cal Western? And talk about the difference in those two speeches and the locations.
Mm-hmm. That speech is actually very much a sermon. It does have a different feel. With the speech there at San Diego State, he's making these arguments and debunking logical moves people make. He says things like, we can't use the tragic results of segregation as an argument for its continuation. And that sets a stage for him now to come in later on in that day to have a speech that's much more about painting a picture of who people have been and who we need to be. And he relies on a sermon that he has given in many places, both before and after the time that he was here. It's called Remaining Awake Through a Great Revolution. And here what he's saying is people are currently in a moment where they have to make some important decisions. And there is a real temptation to simply, you know, stick your head in the sand, close your eyes, say that it doesn't matter. Say things like, well, you know, politics aren't my thing. And he's saying, this is not a moment to do that. This is a time to become aware that justice is on the line. And it's interesting that he uses this language of remaining awake, language around being woke or staying woke. It's often attacked now. It's misused to mean all kinds of things it didn't mean. But what he's saying is you have to remain aware. When justice is on the line, don't turn away out of comfort and convenience. Pay more attention.
Yeah. Part of your jobs as professors, you know, is to teach these important lessons in history. And, you know, when we fast forward to today, there are efforts across the country to axe ethnic studies or ban Black history in curriculum, especially in Florida. I mean, what are your reactions to those things? And how do institutions push back on the erasure of history? And how does the fight continue? Because it seems like there are a lot of aspects of the Civil Rights Act that are being eroded.
I think this is one of the most powerful questions when you engage with this history, in that when you look at the original words of Dr. King's speeches, you get inspiration that answers some of the misinformation and propaganda that's out right now, especially attacks on ethnic studies, especially attacks on immigration, especially attacks on equality. When I teach these speeches to my students, I watch them to see what resonates with them. And when Dr. King is talking about integration as excellence, as everybody bringing something to the table, I'm reminded of this one passage that I absolutely love because my students just light up when they hear this part of the speech from Cal Western. Dr. King says, if it falls your lot to be a street sweeper, sweep streets like Michelangelo painted, sweep streets like Beethoven composed music, sweep streets like Shakespeare wrote poetry, sweep streets so well that all the host of heaven and earth will have to pause and say, here lived a great street sweeper who swept his job well. And the reason I love this is because it pulls us away from these inflammatory phrases that people have a gut reaction to, whether it's political correctness or woke, things that they're just ready to dismiss. And they start feeling this inspiration that is about unity, that it's about integration, and that it's about finding commonality. And so that's what I see as the answer. And that's the optimism I have is with today's youth.
Yeah. And at the same time, though, current white supremacist groups, the number one target they have are young people. They target young people through video games. They target young people through, you know, rallies. And sometimes, unfortunately, because of the way misinformation works, because of the polarization that's at play, a lot of young people don't realize what they're a part of until they're deep in it. And so it is true that, you know, on a broad sense, young people do see through this, but young people are still young people. They're still people being formed. They're still people in need of mentors who are dedicated to justice and freedom. They still need mentors who are dedicated to that discerning work. And I think that still remains our job. You know, when it comes to this idea of removing the challenge to ethnic studies, or wanting to stop teaching history around racial injustice. I mean, King was aware that people were ready to sleep on those things even in his day. When he was in St. Augustine, what they would do as part of their work of protests, of their demonstrations, they would lead these nightly pilgrimages to an area of town called the Old Slave Market. And it was a place where African-American people were sold as slaves. And this spot was like a celebrated spot in the town. And what they would do is they would lead pilgrimages from a church in town. They would walk down, turn the corner, make their way to that spot and pray. Of course, the way there and the way back was filled with a lot of violent resistance. But their point was to say, this place, this space, this ground we walk on is filled with buried stories that need to be told and not forgotten. And it's us who have to tell the story, because the moment we stop telling it, the eraser comes out and people don't want to deal with these realities. And what happens when the eraser does its work and the erasure takes place is we're left with realities of injustice and the inability to talk about why we are where we are.
Monte brings up a very important point that it's up to us and that we need to be strategic. And I would add, anniversaries are crucial. And so this is on us to not only emphasize these important anniversaries, but also tie it into living history. Some of those civil rights leaders in San Diego, like Hal Brown, Hal is in San Diego. He is still incredibly vibrant and smart and well-spoken. And he gives speeches that talks about not only racial equality, but that economic equality and opportunity is the key fight for today's world. And so I think those two things, not only being strategic with anniversaries, but also having that direct tie to living history, that is what really brings the point home.
Very much true. And so, you know, the work didn't stop in 1964. It continues today. And I appreciate you both picking up the baton. Also, you mentioned Hal Brown. I'll be talking with him later this hour. I've been speaking with Montague Williams, Professor of Church, Culture, and Society at Point Loma Nazarene University. He's also the author of Church in Color, Youth Ministry, Race, and the Theology of Martin Luther King Jr. Montague, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, for sure. Thank you.
Also, Seth Malios, Professor of Anthropology and University History Curator at San Diego State University. Seth, thank you for being here.
Pleasure, Jade. Thanks.
Coming up, Harold K. Brown, one of San Diego's civil rights leaders, shares his childhood experience and how those experiences motivated him to stay in the fight.
Those things all piled up in my mind, and they stayed there, and I resented them, and I hated them, and I decided that I would speak up.
His path to healing when we return.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Today on the show, we are honoring the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. We just learned about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s visit to San Diego universities, but the movement wasn't just about leaders like Dr. King. Activists across the country were involved, including those right here in San Diego, like Harold K. Brown. Back in 1971, Hal became the first Black administrator at San Diego State University. A year later, he helped establish the Afro-American Studies Program, now called the Department of Africana Studies. He also organized local movements to push for desegregation in San Diego neighborhoods. And that work continues still today as Hal fights for civil rights and economic development. Last week, I had the honor of speaking with Hal in studio. I began by asking what the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 meant to him.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, we all rejoiced. We were very actively involved in the civil rights movement at that time, so I was still leading the civil rights organization, of CORE. But we rejoiced, but we had our hands still full. In 1964, we were still actively picketing and demonstrating against the same things of discrimination and that the 1964 Civil Rights Act was addressing. We were still involved in doing the kinds of things that would eventually be alleviated because of the passage of such a great bill. I mean, so comprehensive, it covers so much, and we were just overjoyed when that was passed.
Yeah. And it's far reaching, too, I think, because a lot of people kind of miss that.
Yes, it is far reaching. And it just covers, you know, everything from discrimination in housing and discrimination in employment and in facilities, accommodations, social accommodations, which is a real another story. But yeah, it just covered, you know, so much. And although it wasn't implemented right at that moment, but it covered mm-hmm. a whole area. I mean, and it's regarded as one of the most significant pieces of legislation that we ever had in America.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I'm thinking Title IX, even immigration, all of those things.
All of that came under, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you were very young, okay, when you became active in the civil rights movement. Your call to activism as a student was really born out of lived experiences. Can you tell me how life as a Black student was different from that of white students at that time?
I need to start, when students, I need to start with in my first grade. We all lived in the Black community, of course. This is back in those days where housing was completely segregated, and we lived in I grew up in an alley in Pennsylvania. In my first grade, we were passing, we had to walk a good distance to get to our school for Black kids. And on the way, I can recall white men at the top of this factory, they used to look out their windows and as we were going by and call us, hey, you and Bob, you know. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I said, what's a I've never even heard that word before. And so that was my first introduction. And then when I graduated from high school, there was a picnic to celebrate the graduates at a place that's about 30 miles outside of York. And when we heard that, you can go, but you can't swim in the pool. So I said, forget it. And then we decided we weren't going to that place. So, you know, that went on up through college, running into situations there. I was a chairman of the Constitutions Committee. I was on the student government. I was, my responsibility was to review all the, whatever it took for each organization on campus to have. I reviewed their bylaws, mm-hmm. and the bylaws stated that the fraternities and sororities were for white students. Mm-hmm. And so that was another, knock in the head when I started speaking to groups about the treatment of Blacks in America. And then I was approached by a person, another Black fellow, he said that they were starting a civil rights organization by the name of the Congress of Racial Equality. And would I be interested? And I said, of course I would. So I joined there, and then I became the president or the chairman of that group. And from then on, it was strictly involvement in the civil rights movement.
In that group that you were involved in after graduating college, you really fought to integrate neighborhoods in San Diego County. What did those demonstrations look like?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is that, you know, they were small at that time when I started. One of the first demonstrations that we had was when President John Kennedy came to San Diego to speak here at San Diego State, and we wanted to show him that there were these conditions of segregation and discrimination right here in San Diego. And we held, I was on El Cajon Boulevard, I think was where they brought him down, El Cajon Boulevard. And so we stood there with signs expressing that mm-hmm. how we felt. And this was there was a lot of discrimination here and segregation here as well as in the South.
Well, how did the community respond to that? And how did the Kennedy respond to it?
We never found out how President Kennedy accepted our demonstration. But the interesting part about San Diego at that time was that in the white community, the white community was very conservative, and it's still conservative, but it was very conservative and closed in a lot of ways to Blacks. But When we decided that we were going to really push hard for integration in San Diego and for elimination of job discrimination and elimination of of living facilities like hotels and things. You know, the big hotel, bigger than a hotel in San Diego was the El Cortez. Mm-hmm. And would not allow blacks to live there. And so this whole thing was disturbing back then in a way that there wasn't much that we could do. We had no power in, like, in the city council and board of supervisors and all that. We had no one on those. And so it was tough. But when we demonstrated the same as the demonstrations all over the country were taking place, and not only in the Congress of Racial Equality, which is around the country, but they were the kinds of demonstrations that we had to take according to the resistance that we had, which meant we had the picketing, online picketing, we had the sit-ins, and we had even coin-ins at the banks, because no banks had any blacks or Mexicans or Spanish. I mean, it was always very much closed. And so we took on the Bank of America, the largest bank in California. And that was a tough assignment.
Yeah, it was. My grandmother was the first black bank teller in St. Louis. Mm. They told me how they used to have to close the blinds because people would drive by to look and say, oh, there she is, you know. So, I mean, with such resistance, what kept you going?
My motivation came from two sources. One was that, you know, I watched my mother and my brothers and sisters and my friends, uncles and aunts, and all of us in the black community were restricted to the living of those conditions there, and jobs hardly were available. If they were, they were the lowest jobs that you could get. And so I watched that as I was growing up. And then the incidents that I mentioned to you earlier, those things all piled up mm-hmm. in my mind. And they stayed there. And I resented them. And I hated them. And I decided that I would speak up. When I saw the opportunity to get involved in the civil rights movement, I just jumped at the chance, because then I could express all of those feelings that I had inside. And so that's what I did, and I had an opportunity to work with the Congress of Racial Equality as its local chairman and Western Regional chairman. That was why when I was arrested several times, and I served jail sentences and all of those things. I mean, it was worth it every minute. And I think, as you mentioned, I'm still involved in doing those kinds of things because it's just such a part of me.
You really, in your own way, kind of moved things along to economic development for San Diego's black community, and eventually became a crucial part of your platform. Can you talk about the importance of that?
Yes. As I taught the students when I was still here teaching, that there are two, you should understand that in the United States of America, there are two very important things that makes this country go, and that's the vote and money. And once we learn that, we realize that in the black community, we don't have much money. We can't influence voting. We didn't have the politicians in place. We were somewhat powerless when it came to participating in this United States of America and the economic system of capitalism. And so when I formed this organization called the Black Economic Development Task Force prior to forming the Economic Development Department here, no one, I mean, blacks had never even heard that back in those years. It was so new. And so I just knew that that was the area that was going to be the most important challenge. During the Community Economic Development Program, we were having an outing, and I wrote a paper for that. And I stated in the paper that the Black economic development would be the next phase of the civil rights movement. And that was years, years ago, and here we are. Economic development, we need to participate as we got a late start or almost a no start back during the times when from slavery to Jim Crow and on up. And we realized that we started so far back, but we've got to run even faster than we've been running. And we've got to come together and run together and play together.
Yeah.
We're at the beginning right now. So.
Still. where do you think we are in the civil rights movement today as so many policies chip away at the progress made?
I think where we are, we're in a phase of naivete. People are pretty naive about what's happening today. You know, they're chipping away after all the gains of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. All of those gains are being chipped away by the Republican Party. Removal of any knowledge of slavery and stuff in the schools. Taking America back to what way it was. And what does that mean to people like me? It means going back to the Jim Crow days. And unfortunately, our younger people, most of them, don't even know anything about Jim Crow. So what we need, you know, we need to do is to speak up and speak out and get up and get out and work and work and work. Because if we're going, if these people, the Republican Party, is trying to take us back to the way America was, I mean, that's what America was. After slavery, it was Jim Crow, which was the blockage of any movement for blacks in this country. And it also applied to other people of color as well. You couldn't move forward because you couldn't get the jobs to provide the money to buy homes and buy food and buy all those other things. You were limited. So this is such an important area of time. It's just like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was important. We need another Civil Rights Act today that speaks to the disenfranchisement of black people. You know, we're back to the time where the little power that we have gained, they're threatening to take it away. The Republican Party is threatening to take it away from us.
You know, when we look at the erosion of the Civil Rights Act, you know, we see the attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion. We see the attack on learning about ethnic studies in schools. We see all these barricades to voting and suppression laws in some states. What do you have as a message to share with politicians, public figures who hold the power to make real change? And what policies do you think would move us forward at this point?
Well, there's a lot of talk, as we all know, about reparations. I take a little slightly different approach. I call it reparations. I think that knowing that we have built in America this foundation, just like building a house on foundation. The foundation was atrocious, slavery and everything that followed from slavery. And so I'm pretty sure that we need to find a way to remedy all the stuff that's happened to black people and others in here. And I don't know how we can do it other than through education and other than the vote. because I think those are the two elements that we are so deficient in. Not only vote, but help to support people who would vote in according to our wishes and desires. I think that's what we call some empowerment. If we can get people like that in these positions around the country, then we won't have to worry about anybody threatening to take us back to the Jim Crow area.
That was my conversation with Harold K. Brown, civil rights leader and educator. To learn more about Hal's story, you can read his 2019 book, Fighting the Color Monster. Coming up, a look at what the next phase of the civil rights movement looks like here in San Diego.
You know, we help people to uncover and discover and aspire and imagine ways to create a better world where human dignity is the baseline for how we treat each other as opposed to something that we aspire to see.
More to come when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. To continue our conversation about the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we're shifting our attention to broader efforts of civil and human rights activists. The 1964 Act is a foundation for the rights we have today, but the fight is far from over. Joining me now is Lawana Richmond, the board vice president of Alliance San Diego. Their group advocates for civil and human rights and political engagement in San Diego. Lawana, thank you for joining me today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So glad you're here. So Alliance does significant work with communities of color and immigrant communities in San Diego. How does the Civil Rights Act of 1964 continue to ensure the liberties of these communities?
Wow. Well, you know, these days it feels like it does its best, the best it can under the circumstances to ensure those liberties. And I say that because, you know, right now we're in a time where many of those liberties are being attacked or curtailed. I think the Civil Rights Act laid the foundation for, you know, people to be able to vote and have, you know, enjoy theoretical full citizenship in this country. And it's something that we can point to aspirationally as we look at where we go from here and how we continue to move forward. Because as you know, nothing is static. Things are always going to change. They're either going to get better or they're going to get worse. So, you know, thinking aspirationally, how do we make things better?
Yeah. And, you know, the civil rights we have today were achieved because of people like Hal Brown, who we talked to previously.
Yes.
Yeah, about his work here in San Diego. I'm curious how the efforts and work from the civil rights movement are still echoing in today's civil rights advocacy.
I mean, a big part of, like, right now we're looking at making sure everyone who has the right to vote gets access. So we're supporting and promoting an inclusive democracy, looking at how to make sure that there's full participation in this system, because without it, how do we make it better? And how do we protect people from the tyranny of the majority?
Right. Well, I mean, how does activism today look compared to the movement in the 60s?
Well, you know, many of the things that were done in the 60s, some of them, you know, people are still holding marches and protesting and still writing opinion pieces. Now they're leveraging social media more. The other part, though, in terms of like social action and being able to get people to turn out, for example, at a city council meeting or a county board meeting, board of supervisors meeting, tools like social media are really helpful in reaching more people more quickly.
Yeah, well, and talk to me about that, because when in talking to Hal, you know, he was emphasizing the importance of having one voice to communicate the messaging and sort of control the narrative. What do you think about that in 2024?
I think that when we don't, you know, get clarity of messaging and goals when we have civil action, it dilutes the power of it. Because a united civil action where you're very clear on like what your demands are, what a win looks like, it's very clear, especially when faced with any opposition or even just inquiry, that the message is clear and that the results are moving in the direction that you're trying to move in. When people don't, you know, take advantage of the opportunity to have some consistency in messaging, then, you know, there's all kinds of like, oh, well, we could do this or we could do that. A good example, you know, well, I do appreciate that Juneteenth is a national holiday. There are a lot of other rights that I think are more pressing right now, like just the right to be able to walk down the street free from harassment by law enforcement is an important right.
Right. Well, in the present day movement for civil rights, there's also that connection to human rights. What is the distinction, though, between civil and human rights? And then what's the glue that puts them together?
Civil rights, I mean, you know, to oversimplify it, is, you know, basically a veneer of civility, right? Almost rights to like things and places and to do stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas human rights is honoring the humanity in everyone. And I think some of the challenges with civil rights is they get locked into categories, right? Like, you know, there's a right for these people who fit this description to be able to do this, or a right for people who fit this description to not have to experience that. Whereas human rights are saying that just because you were born and you're human, you have a right to a level of dignity and respect and honor, just to honor your humanity. And when we do that, a lot of the critics of civil rights, which I will continue to say, civil rights are very important. I just would like to see us go further. When we start to take away the boxes and the categories, then you start to kill some of the arguments being made by people who feel left out of the conversation when you talk about civil rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that you often look to the future.
Yeah, I'm an Afrofuturist.
Exactly. So, you know, it plays a big role in the way people see Black identity, agency, and freedom. So for people who don't know, what is Afrofuturism and how does it guide your activism?
So, you know, I'm going to start by saying there are as many definitions of Afrofuturism as there are people defining it. You know, it includes art, literature, culture, the aesthetic, and social justice and equity. And it's basically looking at the future in a way that includes Black people in roles other than subservient. And so I like to tell people that Afrofuturism is inclusive futurism. Because, you know, I work with a global network of Afrofuturists, and none of us talk about like creating a Black planet, which, you know, their Fear of a Black Planet was a Public Enemy album. We're really looking at, you know, creating space where everyone can thrive. And, you know, part of that is, you know, breaking these barriers and creating or co-creating an aspirational future. Where, you know, maybe we've done something to reduce the social determinants of wellness and where people have access to, you know, things like fresh produce without it even being a conversation or consideration, clean drinking water, fresh air, really like basic things that as a human, we should support everyone wanting to have and having access to. And of course, there's opportunities and, you know, and even lifestyle, like the freedom to like just be your actual self.
Yeah. And is that where we pick the baton up? Because as we look to the future, the next generation, you know, participating in the movement, how do you see the activists that are to come carrying on the lessons of those who came before them?
So, you know, I have friends that like used to be in promotions like in the 80s and 90s, like pre-internet, right? And everything was like, you know, you had to get flyers, you had to like fax press releases, and you know, you had to do all these like analog things, right? Now, between the internet, artificial intelligence, and virtual reality, the opportunity for future generations to connect and build and engage in being global citizens are exponential. They're growing at a rate that, you know, the possibilities go beyond anything I personally can imagine. And I get excited by the fact that many of our young people are already living out loud what we wanted for them, what we dreamed about, what Dr. King talked about in the bounced check speech. And, you know, that everybody calls it the dream speech, but it was really the about a bounce check. And there was this little bitty portion where he talked about his dream, and the dream was the part that people felt comfortable with. But, you know, our kids, you know, I'm proud of them. The kids are all right. In fact, they're so all right that it's the reason that we see like so much resistance to this progress, because it's not what a lot of people envision for the future.
And, you know, as we talk about civil rights, there are a lot of parallels between civil rights and human rights, and it is something that is global. So can you talk a little bit about that and what how Alliance San Diego fits into that?
Well, one of the things that Alliance San Diego is doing is we have a human dignity campaign that we've been running, and we're doing workshops. We have workshops that we host at our site, but we will also go work with other organizations to customize workshops on human dignity, where we teach about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and, you know, what it contains, how it's different from the Constitution, which, you know, as we know, there are many things that were legal that weren't necessarily morally right. And, you know, we help people to uncover and discover and aspire and imagine ways to create a better world where human dignity is the baseline for how we treat each other, as opposed to something that we aspire to see.
I've been speaking with LaJuana Richmond, Board Vice President of Alliance San Diego. LaJuana, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
KPBS On Demand is supported by the San Diego County Toyota Dealers. Experience the new 2024 Tacoma at your local dealer and learn about the new lineup, including turbocharged four-cylinder engines and a hybrid powertrain option. San Diego County Toyota Dealers. We make it easy.